Okay, good afternoon. So today is midterm interview. This is going to be, I have nothing specifically prepared, so I will just take your questions of things you'd like me to cover. So I'll just take questions, consolidate them, and we'll try to see what we can get through. So what would you like me to talk about? There's nothing, we're going to be done.
Cash sets.
Cash sets? Anything more specific?
No.
Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Professor Collins, what about matrix scoring?
What about it? Like what it is? Okay. Okay, other, yeah.
Can we quickly go over that question on the last post quiz about the three-way set associated cache?
Okay, last post quiz, three-way sets blocks. Okay. Yeah.
Can we go over the red stalling and then the different combinations of the hashes, like the jump and like the branch not taken and red, or like the memory move and red?
Ret, stalling, and other hazards at the same time. That's what you want to know about? Okay. Yeah. Conflict misses? Like, what about them? What they are, or? Sorry? Okay. Conflict misses versus other kinds of misses. Okay. Yeah.
Two quiz questions. The last quiz is like some byte address is stored in the same block as whatever.
That's already on our list.
That's
awesome. So we'll get there. Okay. Other questions? Is there topics that I should cover? Yeah. Okay. So tag next offset. So okay, I'll start grouping these. Shiz. Risk. Okay, other topic, yeah.
There was a quiz that talked about counting how many stalls would occur in the pipeline. I think it was quiz 13.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Implementing least recently used replacement policy.
Okay. Anything else? Okay, I'm sure people will come up with more later.
Can you go over how out of order a processor works?
Okay. Like, what is out of order?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So, let's start with cache, the sort of tag index offset, cache sets. What are all those things? Nope, it's not actually easy to do that way. So I have this picture from which we've probably seen before. And you might remember from this picture that we have that the sets are the rows here. So we have 8 sets in this picture with 2 entries per set. Each entry has a valid bit, some tag bits, and some data. So each one of those is, so each one of these rows is a set. So within each set, in this cache, there happen to be 2 blocks. That means it's a two-way set associative cache. We sometimes name the columns of blocks ways, which is so we say this cache is two ways. So we have our different parts of our address, which correspond to how we find the location of our byte with in the different steps we have to look things up. So the first thing we do when we look something up in the cache is we go to the appropriate set, in this picture, the appropriate row. And we have 8 possible rows, so we need 3 bits to know which of those 8 rows to use. If we had 16 rows, we'd need 4 bits. If we had 1 row, we'd need 0 bits. So in this case, we have 8 rows, so we need 3 bits, and those are our index bits. So that's how we know what row to go to. And that's how we know how many index bits we have based on how many rows we have to choose from. Yes?
And each row is a set, right?
So each row is a set, yes, in this draw. So we also, once we get a block, once we figure out which block it is, we have an offset. The offset tells us, well, we have multiple bytes in the block. In this case, we have 2 bytes per block. And we need to know which of those bytes was the program actually asking for. This address was referring to a specific byte, and there are multiple bytes in a block. We need to know which one of those 2 that we find we want. So since we have 2 choices, we need 1 bit to distinguish between these 2 choices. If we had 1 byte per block, we'd have 0 bits to do that. If we had 16, we'd have 4. So you can look at the size of the block and figure out how many bits do we need to tell which byte of the block we're interested in. So the other thing, and consistently the most confusing thing for people, is the tag. So when we find a block in this cache, we have to know, well, is that the block that we're interested in? Is that correspond to this address? Or is it some other address that we happened to store there earlier? We need to know whether it's the right thing. We also, in this case, we have 2 blocks to choose from, and we need to know which is which. But even if we only had 1, we need to know, well, is that value I'm reading the one that came from this memory location, or did it come from another memory location? And when we're doing that, we don't need to know about the lower bits of the address, because we know that if we're reading something from here, no matter what the rest of the cache says, we know that it has the index bits 100. We know that because that's the only possible way we would have decided to put something there. We also know that if we see a value here, that it has the offset, all possible combinations of the offset bits. That the first byte has offset bit 0, and the second one has offset bits 1. So we don't need to look at the offset bits to decide whether things match, because we know all of them are covered by the whole by the cache block. But everything else we still need, and we want to check, because we don't want there to be 2 different addresses we think could be this value. We only want exactly 1 address to be the thing we think, yeah, that's the value I found there. So all the remaining bits go in the tag. And we need to store a copy of that, so when we read from this cache, we can check, okay, does the thing that's stored at that block, is that actually the thing I stored from this address or some other address? And checking the tag lets us do that. So any questions about this so far? Yeah?
So
the question is, this a two-way set associated cache? Yes.
But in the blocks itself, you can have 2 types of data? Or does
it this is two-way set associative, so there are 2 blocks per set. Each block has its own tag and own valid bit. Yes?
So what's the purpose of the offset bit again?
The offset, so I could be asking for the B4 here or the B5 here. The offset says which one.
Okay.
So in this case, I'm asking for B5 based on my offset. Because we're storing multiple bytes and our address refers to a single byte. Yes?
Wait, so you said there's 8 rows, so that's 8 sets?
Yes. In this picture, there are 8 rows.
So
each one of those is a set.
So the number of blocks per set is like the number of ways?
Yeah.
And then the number of sets is just the number of sets?
Yeah. Okay. We don't have a different name for that, really.
Yeah.
Yes. I will add that to our list of topics. That would be block versus line. Okay. So that's our general division of our cache. So let's, so tag index offset. So offset, we tells us which byte in block. So true to the k bytes in a block, block implies k bits to know. Index tells us which set in cache. So if we have 2 to the k sets in the cache, k bits to know this. And offs and tag is everything else. Know that address used to store matches address being looked up. Yeah.
So in that last image that you had, if there were only 4 rows, then would the index just have been 00 and the tag would have been like the
yeah. Yeah, so if we had 4 rows instead, we'd lose a bit from our index bits, and it would go into the tag bits, assuming we didn't change the block size. Yeah?
Also, is there any reason you would have the number of ways that's not a power of 2, or like a power of 2?
So the question is, is there a reason to have a number of ways that is not a power of 2? There's nothing stopping you. And if it happens to be, you know, faster, you might do it. There have been real processors with, for example, a 6-way L3 cache. I guess the actual big advantage is that this is a way you can have a 6-megabyte cache, for example, if that's the size you want, which is hard to do otherwise. So the last quiz question, we had a 1.5 meg 3-way cache with, I think, 64 byte blocks. And we know that we have addresses, and we're going to want to split them up. And we know that we have a tag part, then an index part, then an offset part. And they're in that order, because so the blocks are all together, so the offset goes at the end. We use the bits next to the block for the index because we want, if we have an array, we want the array to be spread over all the sets. If we're accessing it contiguously, we don't want it to map. We don't want multiple things that are adjacent in the array to map to the same set. So that's why we use the next bits as the index. It's not some like the higher bits of the address, because then we have lots of conflicts. Okay, and we just need to know how many bits of the address correspond to each. So 64 byte blocks is 2 to the 6 byte blocks. So that's 6 bits for the offset. So then we can say, well, we have 1.5 megabytes of data in the cache divided by 3 blocks per set. Megabytes. So I guess I'll do this way. So, which implies, in 3-way, which implies that we have 0.5 megabytes for each way, for each column of data, is half a megabyte. And, which means that we have 0.5 meg divided by 64 bytes of blocks per way. And if you do out this math, this is 2 to the 19 divided by 2 to the 6th blocks, which is 2 to the 13 blocks, which means 13 bits for the index.
Where did 2 to the 19th?
That's 2 to the 20th is 1 megabyte, so 2 to the 19th is half a megabyte. And when we're talking about cache sizes, we always mean power of 2 megabytes, not power of 10. So, and the tag is everything else. And using this, we can divide up the addresses we were given. I'm probably not going to do that out unless you really want me to. But basically, you take something like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and you turn this into binary. One, and you can extract, figure out which parts are the offset and the index, and hopefully I won't miscount, so 6, 12, 13, index, and the tag. And you can, split up the address that way. So once you've done that, the question asks, same set, so when are two addresses going to go to the same set of the cache? How do we know? The same index, because the index is what we use to determine which row. So same set is same index. How about same block? How do we know that they're going to map be stored in the same block at the same time? So the index and the tag need to match. So they map go to the So not only do they go to the same set, that they're part of the same block. We're going to bring them into memory together. That means they have to be two things we'll store together, which means they have the same tag. The rest of the address is the same. Tag. Another way you can think about this is, these are part of it, that there's a block which starts when we set the index, the block offset bits for zero, all zeros, all the way up to all ones. That's what we're going to store in the cache. So if it's so that's the range which is the same block. And you can compute that for each value. Okay. Any questions about this procedure? Okay, so next was conflict misses versus other kinds of misses. So we have our three C's, so which is compulsory, capacity, and conflict. So compulsory misses mean the first time I access something. They're compulsory because you can't avoid them, you need to access something the first time. As far as we know, you can't avoid them. There's actually going to be ways to avoid them, but we probably won't talk much about them. So we have capacity misses, which is the cache isn't big enough. So the idea of a capacity miss is even if your cache was perfect, there's no way you could possibly keep this value cached because you just don't have enough space. If I'm accessing all of a 10 megabyte array and I have a 2 megabyte cache, I'm going to have lots of capacity misses. Because there's no way I can fit a 10 megabyte array in a 2 megabyte cache. And conflict misses are the cache is big enough, but it just happens that two things map to the same place in the cache, so we couldn't actually store both of the values. So, so we had two things mapped to the same place. One of them had to go, but there would have been stored them elsewhere in the cache. So conflict misses are that we have some coincidence in addresses, so we didn't make full use of our cache. And if we did, we wouldn't have this problem. But because two things mapped to the same place, we ran out of room for things, places we could put that thing. And I should scroll up, I'm sorry. Okay, other questions? There. Okay, so next topic, implementing LRU. So LRU is least recently used. What we want to evict. So we need to track. So for this, to implement this, we need to track when we read something into the cache. We need to know which of our blocks in that set is the one we want to get rid of, which means we need to know when was each one last used. So basically, we want to have an ordering for blocks in a set. And this means this needs to be stored in the tag store. So we'll store this in the tag store that, in addition to the valid bit and the tag bits, we'll store information about the ordering in which blocks were accessed in the set. And to implement LRU perfectly, so for perfect LRU, need to store exact order. So for implementing perfect LRU, we need to store exact order, and that's actually pretty complicated to do. It's definitely doable, but the logic is pretty complicated, especially if you have more than a handful of blocks per set. So often we don't actually implement LRU, but we do something that's kind of like it. But just the idea is we just store the ordering somehow. There's lots of ways you could represent it. I mean, most simply, you could just say, like, if you have three blocks, you need to store one of 0, 1, 2, 0, 2, 1, 2, 1, 0, etc. You just have all those possibilities. You could actually just write them down and have the logic to figure out when I do a new access, how do I change this order? So, questions about that? That makes sense? Not make sense? Yeah.
Can I go back to talking history?
Sure.
So on the most recent quiz, one of the correct answers for reducing compromises was better choice of cache replacement policy. Increased cache accessibility makes sense, but does the cache replacement policy have to be prior to the miss occurring?
So the question is, why do we say that changing the cache replacement policy reduces conflict misses?
Yes.
So there's some cases where two things map to the same place in the cache, and one of them had to go, and because of the replacement policy, maybe we didn't make the best possible choice.
Okay.
And we're going to, of which one to make get rid of.
Okay.
A better replacement policy might make us make a better choice and reduce what we would call a conflict miss. So the problem was that two or more, often like three or four things, map to the same place. And one way of getting rid of some of those misses, but not all of them, is choosing which one to get rid of as the thing that we will access less often in the future. Yeah?
In the 2014 test, there was something about a coldness.
About a what?
Coldness.
Cold miss is another name for compulsoriness. The cache is cold because just started, is the idea.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you go over write back versus
write through? Sure. I'll add that to our list. Other cache topics I'm missing? Yeah.
So back to her question, so how would you, if it maps to the same place, then are you saying that you just would replace the one that you?
So the reason it matters is that it's this one of them had to go. And I see that doesn't actually highlight things very well. One of them had to go is the sort of idea. If we choose when we have to choose which one to make let go, there's a better choice. And if we make, so one choice is better than the other and we'll have less conflict misses. It's possible both choices will have conflict misses, but one is probably going to have less. And I guess I should say it's two or more things. So we might have so it's quite possible we'll have like three things and we can let any, and there's two of them to obviously let go that we can choose from. One choice is going to have less conflict misses because that thing will be accessed less in the future. But they're all going to, but there's probably still going to be some conflict misses from those three things.
Talk about the effects of increasing the cache block size.
Okay. So cache block size, increasing effect. Okay. Yeah.
So is a capacity miss essentially like a special form of a conflict miss in that sense? Since if the cache is full and you try to put something into it,
so the question is the a capacity miss a special form of a conflict miss? So we want these to be distinct categories. One way of sort of getting the intuition for whether something is a capacity miss is that is would it be a miss in a fully associative cache? That is associativity, fully associative, if you don't remember, is associativity equals number of blocks. Right, so capacity miss or misses were even if we had a fully associative cache with the best possible replacement policy, it would still be a miss. Or maybe not the best, but a good replacement policy would still be a miss. That's sort of the intuition you should have. You obviously don't actually implement like 1,024-way caches, typically. I guess there are probably actually some, but in real computers, but not for memory. Okay, so next topic, block versus line. So cache block and cache line. So our usual distinction is line is block plus metadata that is valid and tag bit. Sometimes some sources block equals line. We're not going to ask you about the difference between the two because of that. They are different from sets, though. Yes?
So there was a question, and it says which of the following caches has the largest blocks?
Okay.
It's question one on 2016 spring.
Okay, we'll get to that, get to that later. Okay, so I'll just answer these try in order. So write back versus write through. So write through is when you get a write, do it immediately to memory. So that's the write through policy. Basically, cache doesn't, you might put the value in your cache, but you're gonna always go immediately to the next level of the cache for memory when you get a write. Write back is when you get a write, store locally, do it to memory only when you would otherwise lose the value. So this needs extra state, dirty bit, is value not set in memory yet. So basically this means, and I guess it's on replacement. So with a write back policy, we just store it in the cache, and later on when that value somehow would be removed from our cache, or maybe earlier, we need to actually send it to memory so we don't forget about the write. Otherwise, we just stored it in our cache and then didn't do anything, and we somehow had to replace that part of our cache, we would never know that value again. Yeah?
So is dirty bit like another bit you have in addition to like the valid bit?
Yes, so the dirty bit would go basically next to the valid bit for each block. Yeah?
So is the only advantage of write-through that it's simpler?
So the question is the only advantage of write-through that it's simpler? That's not quite. So implementing, the main advantage is that it's simpler, it can be faster. So when you're doing write back, your cache replacement is more expensive. Because on replacement, you might have to also do a write in addition to a read, which doesn't happen with write through. So it's a little more complicated than just being simpler, but that's one of the bigger advantages. Okay, other questions on write back versus write through? Okay, so cache size increasing, the effect of increasing the cache size, cache block size. So the intuition is larger blocks are gonna give you more locality, so more spatial locality, but more conflict misses. And there's more conflict misses since there's less sets from when you have larger blocks. or less sets to choose from, or locations in set, or blocks in a set. Because if you have larger blocks, you have to get rid of something if you have the same cache size. So you pick the cache size, you either have less sets, which means that you're more likely to have conflicts misses, or you have less blocks per set, which means you're more likely to have conflict misses. But you get better advantage, more, you get more advantage from spatial locality with larger blocks, because there's more often you're going to fetch something, you're going to fetch more stuff around it, so that access is going to hit the cache more often. And the shape of the trade-off curve for block size was that, you know, that there was some maximum, and when the block size kept getting larger and larger, you started getting more cache misses because of the conflict misses. When it got too small, you got more cache misses because you had we're not taking advantage of spatial locality. So that's the effect on hit rate. So also larger blocks have are slower to read write from next level. So you have some disadvantage for miss penalties and things like that, and hit times. And also larger blocks are slower to read from data array, read write from data array. So if you have larger blocks, things are slightly slower, possibly slower to read write from data array. I'm not sure if that's always true. The data array is the same size, but probably. So you have some slight speed changes when you have larger block sizes. But the main difference is in the hit rate that you have. With very small block sizes, you don't get any spatial locality advantage. With very large block sizes, you have conflict misses all the time. Another way of thinking it is more conflict misses because bringing in more data you don't use. That when you bring in a large block and you don't use all of that block, as many programs do, that's wasted space in your cache. This is another way of thinking about why there's more conflict misses with larger blocks. If you had perfect spatial locality, it would be different, but few programs have the best possible spatial locality. Especially since that contradicts having the best possible temporal locality. Yeah?
Why would it hurt the hit rate for programs that have more temporal locality than spatial?
So if you have temporal locality, you're accessing one thing over and over again, not adjacent things. Right? They're kind of in conflict. So I guess you could have pretty good of both, but they're not the same thing. And the sorts of things which will benefit from which will have really good temporal locality could easily have bad spatial locality. Like if you're accessing two things which aren't necessarily next to each other repeatedly, that program might have really, really good temporal locality. And we tend to have worse spatial locality. I guess it's not a given that, I was probably wrong in stating that they're exactly in contradiction. But it's common for programs which have better temporal locality to not have as good spatial locality, just because they're accessing less stuff at a time. Yeah?
So the fall 2016 exam says that making a block bigger does not change the cache size. Can you explain why that is?
So I think that was a setup of the question.
Oh, okay.
Probably. So you can change the block size without changing the cache size as long as you adjust something else.
So the question, let's
read the question carefully. What's the whole question?
Caches can be described in terms of address size, tag size, block size, and lines per set.
Okay, so those are the things we're keeping the same. Okay. So those are the things, except for the block size, we're keeping the same. So if you compute the cache size based on those attributes, you'll find out that the block size doesn't matter, is what happens. And this is a subtle thing because one of the things was tag size. So But the reason why is because of the other things we fixed. So if we didn't fix number of blocks per set, it might not be the same way. Or if we didn't fix the tag size, it might not be the same way. Okay. So then how do you figure out which cache has largest blocks? So the logic here, so it depends on, I don't know the exact context of the question, but the general strategy for questions like these is you want to figure out the blocks, so is that you, that there are ways you can figure out the block size. So one way is, can you find out the number of offset bits? So if you can find out the number of offset bits, that will tell you the block size. And knowing number of tag or index bits probably helps if you need to figure out the number of offset bits. Yeah?
Can you do like an example for that?
An example for this? Do you have it in front of you?
Yeah, it's spring 2016, question one.
What are the numbers it gives?
Fully associative cache with 6-bit tags and 128 lines.
6-bit tags, 128 lines, which is equals blocks. Okay. So
I was just wondering, is there like an easier way to determine this without like
running? Did it tell you how big an address is or no?
No, they didn't tell you. They just have like a fully associated cache with like 6-bit tags and 128 lines, or a direct map cache with the same things, or a direct map.
Oh, which has more? Okay. So let's fix an address size because we're comparing. Let's just take this attribute. So we have a 16, let's say we have, let's choose a number, let's say we have 10-bit addresses. So if we have 6-bit tags, this is a fully associative cache, so how many index bits do we have? So how many sets do we have in a fully associative cache? One. Everything is in one set. A direct map cache is the other way around. Everything is in a different set. So we have one set, which means we have zero index bits. So if we have a 10-bit address, then it's a 6-bit tag, which we're told, 0-bit index, and a 4-bit block. So we would have then 16-byte blocks. And you could do something similar for all the other caches that they give you the attributes for. Here I'm just for convenience assuming an address size, but they don't give you one, which means that you can choose any one and you should get the same answers, assuming you choose a big enough address size that it makes sense with all the caches.
Well, one of the answers is the answer depends on the address size.
Okay.
So is that like a trick question, or would you say, it depends on the address size?
So we can do this without knowing the address size. If we do a bit of work, we can just say n-bit addresses. So n-bit address gets split into a n-6 bit, that and an n-6 bit blocks, which means 2 to the n-6 bytes. So we can just do it with a variable for the address size and figure it out that way.
But what if every single one had a different address size?
If they're, usually the address size is fixed by the system they're in, is what we'll say. It would be very mean to ask a question where you have different address sizes, because that's like determined by what our processor does, not by our cache. Yeah?
So in that example, how many index bits would there be if it was direct map?
So let's say, direct mapped. So how many indexes, so how many sets do we have? Well, we have one set per block because it's direct mapped. So 128 sets, and that's 2 to the 9 sets, which means, sorry, that's not 2 to the 9 sets, that's 2 to the 7 sets, which means we have 7 index bits. And so an n-bit address would be 6-bit tag, 7-bit index, and n-7-6 bit block.
So if it was 2 two lanes that are associated, then it would be a 6-bit index instead of 7?
Yes. Okay, other cache questions? Okay, so I'll go on to our next topic, matrix squaring, what is it? So this is linear algebra. We aren't trying to cover linear algebra, it's just that many of the examples of where caches matter the most happen to be from linear algebra. So matrix squaring is for all I, J, K, A, so if we're doing B equals A squared, where A and B are matrices, the formula for this is for all I, J, K, that B of I, comma, J equals, I guess I should write it out more directly. So B of I, comma, J equals the sum for all k of a I k times a k j. So this is just from linear algebra. We don't expect you to know this, but if you want to understand that example, that's the formula for matrix squaring, just from linear algebra. And we implemented this in our example as a loop. A triply nested loop where we set B of IJ plus equals A of IK times A of KJ. So that's just a way of implementing the sum as a triply nested loop. That's what our example was. And the advantage of writing it in this way is that we could reorder the loops and change how we access memory for A and B. And because we're accessing a lot of memory, this is a case where the performance of our cache varies a lot, matters a lot, and because we can have choice on our order, it's a case where we can change our performance a lot. And that was what was important about the example. We don't intend to ever test you on your knowledge of linear algebra in this class, but we just use it as examples because if you're acting on big arrays of stuff, you're probably doing linear algebra at some point. And this is where in the real world these problems with cache performance most commonly come up. Well, one of the places. Something which looks like linear algebra. Maybe it's not directly linear algebra, but ends up looking like linear algebra. So any questions about these formulas and how we implemented them? Yeah?
So I remember this matrix multiplication has something to do with spatial or temporal locality. So
the question is, what's the relationship between spatial and temporal locality? So depending on the loop order, so the question is locality and AI, locality here. So the question is, what's locality like in this loop? So for example, with this loop order, this is AIK, we have good temporal locality in BIJ, for example. Right, this is a good way of illustrating cases where we have varying locality. So we have good temporal locality in BIJ, we have good spatial locality in AIK if rows are stored together. Right, it's an example of spatial and temporal locality because when we choose the order we compute things in, we're gonna have some types of locality or not. And as a programmer who wants this to be fast, your job is to actually manage this locality, and most of that choice is the order you compute things in, not actually what computation you're doing, which you don't really get to choose. Yeah?
Can you explain why it's good temporal locality and good spatial locality?
So why is this good temporal locality in BIJ? So in each iteration of the loop over K, we're accessing the same element of B. the same thing over and over again. So that's why we have excellent temporal locality. If rows are stored together and I is the row, rows, I'll just notate a row, comma, col, just to be clear. If rows are stored together and I is the row, then we're accessing parts of the same row in the K loop. So we have good spatial locality in AIK. If rows weren't stored together, that wouldn't matter. And different orders have different locality, as we talked about. We'll talk again about blocking after the exam, because you'll have to do it at some point. But that's all about about when you have this sort of choice, about making it best for the cache, which is basically about managing what types of locality you have and where you have locality to make it fit best in the cache. So other questions about this example? Comments? Okay, so ret stalling and other hazards at the same time. So the question is, if we have something like a ret and something else going on. So let's say we have JLE happening and we detect a misprediction. What should happen? When we detect a misprediction, I guess I should probably do this on a different format. So we have, that was not where I wanted to present that. So we have, let's say JLE, ret. So JLE is going fetch, decode, execute. Then ret is going fetch, decode. And then we have the thing after ret, which is supposed to stall. So what should happen next? In this case, if the JLE is, I'll say, is mispredicted, what's the next thing that should happen? So when are we going to know that the JLE is mispredicted in our pipeline? After execute. So we're going to act on that information in memory of JLE. So during the next cycle, we're going to use our misprediction information to decide what to do. So what should we be doing?
Bubble.
Sorry?
We have to bubble.
So we're going to have to bubble, yes. So let's do this step by step. So we're going to, what's the next instruction that's going to run in fetch? Is it going to be, what instruction should that be? What? So, yeah.
You can do like an MRQ or something.
So where is it going to come from? Where is this this blank instruction here? Where does that come from?
Do you mean like after you do?
What instruction is it after, let's say? Or where do I get its address? The instruction that's in fetch after the instruction what was running after ret. So in the cycle during that in the cycle when JLE is in its memory stage. Yeah.
Instruction after the JLE.
Yeah, so this is after JLE in program. So if we have JLE foo and we have add, this will be, let's say, add. That's what our program looks like. So that's the instruction we want to fetch next. So what should happen to the ret? Should the ret execute its execute stage? Some people are shaking their heads. So no, because we weren't supposed to run either of these instructions. So we shouldn't have run the ret and we shouldn't have run the instruction after the ret that we started doing something for but we're stalling for. So neither of these things should be happening. And so we're gonna need, so we want to bubble. So the decode is gonna go, I should use a different color for this. So the, yeah, different color. So the decode is gonna go to a bubble. The fetch is gonna go to a bubble. So, which is exactly what you usually do when we have a misprediction. It doesn't matter that the ret is going on, it better not be the case that the ret somehow wins and we keep, and we do something broken, like keep running the, like run the ret's execute memory and write back stage. We better not do that. And we also better not do something where we keep stalling for the ret, because the JLE should win. Yeah.
So I understand that, but when you're doing ret anyways, like you're stalling F. So even if JLE is like, oh, like update PC, the stall F signal is true, isn't it? Because you're in.
So the question is, well, the way I was implementing this JLE was that I did something like stall f equals is ret thing happening. And well, maybe you were doing that. So either you need to make sure that it doesn't matter. So yeah. Either, so the f underscore PC shouldn't matter. Change the mispredict logic. So either the predicted PC shouldn't change the mispredict logic, so the stalling won't matter. Or change the stall F logic. So one of those two things needs to be true about your processor. So either it won't matter if you're stalling, or you need to change the stall logic to handle that differently. Okay. So any questions about sort of this? So I guess maybe I can go over any other conflicts that are confusing people about conflicts with rets. Was it just the ret and other hazards? Probably should go over the other case, which is that we had it was just ret and other hazards. Okay, so the other case is not that. Any other hazards we should go over? I guess we'll go over counting stalls question then. So the quiz had this example, something like this. So pop RAX and add RAX, RBX, let's say, then pop RAX again, then RM move R, yeah, that RM move Q RAX to somewhere. So let's think about how this looks on the pipeline. So we have fetch, decode, execute, memory, write back. And this add needs the value that this pop produces. And so our pop produces the value here, and it needs to be available for the add. So the add actually, you know, has to, needs it in its execute stage, so we need a stall. In order to handle that. So then, after that, we can fetch our other pop. This doesn't need anything special. And this, again, produces a value in its memory stage. which is going to be needed by this rmove q. But if we just run this normally, the rmove q needs the value in memory, and it has it. So we don't need to do anything special besides implement forwarding. This might be a forwarding path you forgot in your pipe homework too, but it's a valid forwarding path, so we don't need a stall. Yeah?
Yeah, so can we use forwarding to handle this case?
Yeah, so we can use forwarding. Forwarding just can be into later in the pipeline, and that's what we'll do. So we'll forward from the end of memory to the end of x cubed. And that we can do in this case because we don't need RAX until memory. Yeah? Yes. So this first stall here is an example of that. So this stall still needed to happen because there's no possible way we could forward unless we stalled. Yeah.
So in the pipe homework for this week, I don't think we were told to implement like the second forward.
We may have forgotten to test for this, but in a real processor, you'd want to implement it because it makes things a lot faster if you don't stall in that case, and there's no reason to stall. And real processors do implement a forwarding path like this, which have so there are real processors which have basically the same pipeline design that we have for a y86 processor. They don't implement y86, obviously, but, and they implement this forwarding path because it matters. Yeah?
In the add queue, the first one is an RAX, and then pop queue is an RCS, right? The second pop queue, I can't really use that.
Oh, sorry. This is RAX, RAX, RAX. Okay. So I will highlight our dependencies to make this clearer. So this goes to here, and this goes to here. Okay, so that's the counting stalls question. Any other pipelining questions? Comments? Not right now. Okay. So out of order, what is it? So the idea of out of order is, and I didn't switch, of course, because why would I have? I keep forgetting that my display is not the same as yours. So the idea of out of order, the basic idea, is that when we have something like RMQ, RAX into RCX, and then we have a whole bunch of unrelated instructions, we probably should use a different equal and. So, probably should still use a different example, but like IR move Q. That we would really like to execute, that if we are. If this instruction is going, is doing fetch, decode, execute, memory, 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 dot, if that's what that instruction does, because memory is really slow, we would like it to be the case that we can actually somehow squeeze these other instructions in here. And that's what an out-of-order processor does, that we will execute these other instructions in spite of this instruction not finishing. So our timeline is going to be that we somehow manage to keep going in the program while we're waiting for this long load. So that's the idea of out of order, is to do this and to just keep executing other instructions while we're waiting for some long instruction, just based on when values are available. So in this case, this instruction needs the value of RCX, and none of these instructions use RCX to read from. This IR move queue writes to RCX, but that doesn't matter because it doesn't need to read RCX to do that. So there's no dependency, so why can't we just keep executing instructions? This is what out-of-order processors do. So there's a bunch of extra work you need to do that, which we're not going to talk in that much detail about how you implement. But this is a big speed improvement, especially when you have things like memory accesses that are slow, like caches have, when there's a cache miss. Yeah?
And so like, you need two different memory processors or whatever to do this, right?
So the question is, we need two memories to do this?
Or like...
We need a memory which can handle multiple things at once. Yeah. So... usually on an out-of-order processor, we will actually not have a memory stage of instructions that don't need it. Like, the instruction execution will probably look more like that. So there won't actually be a memory stage. If there was some memory operation, we would need, yes, to have a memory which can handle multiple things at once. And this is another thing real out-of-order processors do. It is very complicated. In fact, probably one of the most complicated parts of an out-of-order processor. Yeah?
So are most modern processors out of order?
So most modern desktop-oriented processors are out of order, and I guess mobile ones too. Some lower power processors are not. Because out of order, so to implement out of order, you need, it's keeping independent instructions. So to implement, we need to have dependency checking. So you have dependency checking in your pipeline processor, but it's much more complicated in an out-of-order processor. You also need precise exceptions, which means restore old state if something fails. So if the rmove queue seg faults, we want to actually go back and undo all these arithmetic operations. And that's what we talked about the reorder buffer for. So that's an extra level of complication in implementing an out-of-order processor. So all that stuff takes up power. So although it's faster, it is not free. It also makes designing out-of-order processors a lot harder than designing a pipeline processor. And also testing them is a lot harder. If you think that it's complicated to worry about ret and halt and conditional jumps happening at the same time, it gets much worse when you have to worry about ret and halt and conditional jumps happening at the same time while you're also executing a load that you also have instructions running after. Okay. Other questions on out of order? Okay, so order, now I guess I did it wrong. Okay, so this is the entire list of topics we constructed, but I'm sure people have more questions, so yeah.
Can you go over the reorder buffers?
Sure, reorder buffers. So let's return to this example. So the case where a reorder buffer is going to matter most obviously is, let's say that this seg faults. And in our debugger, I would like to look at the seg fault and say, what was our CX? But if we just do the natural thing, then we're going to say, oops, this is our CX. That's really problematic. Also, I'm going to want to say, what was R8? I'm going to think, you know, because maybe R8 was used to compute RCX, even if we stop here. So I might say, what's R8? And I might get this value. And that's not going to make sense. If I have a seg fault on an MR move queue instruction, I expect that all these instructions didn't happen. That makes sense? So that's the idea of precise exceptions. So reorder buffer is a way of implementing it. And basically, what the... I probably should not draw over that. What the reorder buffer is going to have is it's going to have an entry for each instruction, and we'll say something like RCX equals question mark, and addQ will say R9 equals like 15, subQ will say R8 equals 100, and so on. So we'll have entries for the results of instructions. And on an exception, we'll just discard on seg fault. We'll just discard those extra entries and be able to know and have our old values because we've only stored them in the reorder buffer. So the reorder buffer is just the extra way to keep track of values we've computed, but where we're not sure that we won't have something strange happen, like a seg fault, and not want them anymore. And this is so when you're like debugging or something like that, you see the you don't see values from, say, this add instruction that don't exist because the previous instruction seg faulted. Yeah?
So do they also store lines that are in the registries previously?
So the typical implementation, there are multiple ways to implement things like a reorder buffer. The typical implementation is this, that this is where we store the values until we're done with the instruction. And it's also where we read the values from until we're done with the instruction. That's the most common way of implementing it. There's an alternate implementation, which some real processors use, where you instead store the old values or something like that. But the important thing is that it gives you enough information to get rid of the new values. However, whether you do that by having a copy of the old or new value doesn't matter so much. Okay. Other questions? Yeah?
This exam is not cumulative, right?
This exam is, yeah, it is not formally cumulative, but you know, if you have to know about YD6, don't be surprised. Or if you have to read a little bit of C code, don't be surprised. Other questions? Well. Yeah, question? No? Yes?
A lot of the past exams have a lot of focus on like the caching part. Would you say that's probably like true for our semester, even though we learned like, I guess, like different stuff than all the past?
So about half the exam will be pipelining, about half will be caching. Which is about how we covered things in the class, so. Other questions? Am I really done with this? Okay. Yeah.
In an out of order format, so can you only commit something after like the instruction has been committed?
Excuse me. So the question is, if we have out of order dispatch, can we only commit something after the previous? Yeah. So part of the idea of the reorder buffer is that we don't remove anything from the reorder buffer until we have no question marks left above it. So yeah, precisely that. We commit in order is what we said.